will cooperate on cases of international tax evasion, but it vowed to stand behind traditional secrecy of Swiss bank accounts. Foreign governments have focused hard on Switzerland after the U.S. pursued taxpayers who have allegedly hidden assets in numbered Swiss bank accounts. The Swiss bank UBS settled with the U.S. government and pledged to stop offering opportunities to U.S. citizens that would allow them to hide taxable assets. There's been an oil spill off the northeast coast of Australia. Officials have declared a disaster zone along some of the country's most popular beaches. Tons of fuel oil have leaked from a cargo ship and blackened the fine white sand there for miles. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, working with states to protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control corrections costs at pewtrusts.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. In this hour, Focus 580, we'll be talking about a Supreme Court case that is very important and at the same time not very widely known. This is the case of Buck v. Bell. It dates from 1927. The ruling in this case allowed states to forcibly sterilize people that the state considered to be, and I quote here, socially inadequate, and among other things, this decision of the Supreme Court has never been overturned. Our guest for the program is Georgia State University law professor Paul Lombardo. And to the extent that people do know about this, it's in large part due to the fact that he has written a good deal and spoken a good deal about it. He says this particular case represents one of the low points in Supreme Court history, not only because the opinion was callous, but because it was based on deceit and betrayal. He tells the story in a recently published book, and the title of his book is Three Generations, No Imbeciles, Eugenics, the Supreme Court, and Buck v. Bell. And as we give you some of the background of the story, the title, the significance of the title that he has put on his book will become very evident. The book is published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. As I mentioned, our guest Paul Lombardo is professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law, and he's played a very important role both as an historian and a lawyer in the movement to solicit state apologies and legislative denunciations of past eugenics laws. Professor Lombardo, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much. I'm good, thanks. And yourself?
Great.
I appreciate you giving us some of your time. Before going on to talk specifically about the case and about Carrie Buck and about who she was, I think to establish some context, we need to talk about the attitude that was in place at the time. Here we're talking about the sort of mid to late 20s, an attitude that was once widely held, and maybe some people still have it, that a wide range of social problems or problem behaviors, things like criminality, substance abuse, out-of-wedlock birth, and also people would toss into that things like mental illness, developmental disability, all of that, all of those things were genetically linked. And there were people who were making this argument that says, well, if you don't want to have those things, the best way to get rid of them is to keep people who did them and who exhibited those behaviors and had those characteristics, the best thing you could do is keep those people from having children. And that was, as I said, that was once a very widely held kind of idea.
No question about it. The notions of eugenic birth, the word itself means to be well-born, focused on the power of heredity, the idea that almost everything, behavior, moral habits, physical characteristics, all those things were thought to be somehow coded in what they called the germplasm. The term that we would use today would be the DNA. Heredity was really the linchpin of eugenic theory, and the notion, as you suggest, that we could have a world that was somehow utopian, that didn't have people with disabilities, didn't have criminals or poor people or anyone who might be a burden on society, that all those things could be done if we could simply breed people the right way. That was the focal point of the eugenics movement, at least in this corner of it that focused on sterilization.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to underline here the idea that they are dumping in all sorts of things, and that is for people who advocated this or had this kind of worldview, they considered to be criminal behavior and as something that was a tendency that could be genetically passed on. But they also, poverty was considered to be a kind of a condition that could be passed on.
We have many states that are considering, and then later some of them even adopting laws as late as the late 20s that look at a bounty that should be put up by people who have certain conditions. A law is introduced in 1915 or so in Massachusetts that says anybody who's blind can't get married unless they put up a bounty of $10,000. And the purpose of that bounty would be to be put in trust, and if they had children, the children would be supported by the money. So this was, in essence, a roadblock for people who were disabled to get married, the assumption being that their children would become a tax burden on the rest of society.
Yeah. And so at some point we're talking about a point where many people, state officials particularly, felt that it was perhaps their responsibility, their duty to look at people that were in its care, who had been, particularly here, I guess we're talking about people who were in various kinds of institutions for various sorts of reasons, that these were the targets of their intentions, and that they felt that they almost had that responsibility to make sure that these people didn't have children.
Well, there's an interesting change of attitude that takes place between around 1910 and the 1930s. In the 19th century, in the 1800s, we have institutions being built all over the country. From the early part of the 19th century on, you have large asylums being built to take care of people with mental illnesses. You have colonies being built to take care of people with what we would call today mental retardation or developmental delay, tuberculosis sanitaria, all kinds of places like that. And by the turn of the 20th century, it becomes clear that institutions like that, motivated out of the best compassion of society, were expensive, and that those expenses began to pile up over time. And the better you were at diagnosing those conditions and identifying the people who might have them and getting them into the institution, the more expensive it would be. And so the general idea, this utopian notion that you could have a society that didn't have social problems within it, while many people would have applauded that, there was a very clear fiscal point to the way the politicians spun that argument, because it was focused on people in institutions primarily, as you say.
Mm. And again, here we're talking about this case being it was part of it, let's say, a larger sort of movement that was going on in the country and in various states, where they were trying to develop a kind of a law that would protect doctors who were willing to do this and yet hesitant to do it, fearing that they'd be sued for malpractice. What there was this effort that was going on to develop a law that would protect the doctors, that would stand up in court, and that would allow states to safely do this without fear that the people who were the targets of the sterilization would then come back afterwards and attempt to sue them.
Well, in this particular case, that is a very clear motive. It is while the politicians and others might want laws like this, the people who actually had to carry them out, if they were willing to, were the superintendents or the directors or the wardens in some cases of these very institutions. They were the ones who had to make the choices about who got sterilized and when, and they were the ones who had to defend the lawsuits if there were any repercussions. So we have a case that arises out of the desire of one very particular doctor in Virginia named Albert Priddy. Dr. Priddy had started sterilizing people around 1916, And it's clearly part of the record that he sterilized women mostly, and he had strong feelings about which kinds of women he should sterilize. He was interested in wiping out immorality and prostitution, and he thought that you could do this by rounding up the streetwalkers and sterilizing them, and so that's what he focused on. Turns out he was sued by a family, a man whose daughters and wife were taken from their home, on the allegation that they'd been involved in running a brothel. And Dr. Priddy took him to the Virginia Colony for the Epileptic and the Feeble-Minded, the institution that he ran, eventually sterilized a couple of them, only to find that the father of that family, called the Mallorys, had taken him to court and sued him for what today we would consider straightforward malpractice. He didn't lose that case, but he was very embarrassed, Dr. Priddy was, about being dragged into court. He didn't like the publicity, and he felt that was a great affront to his professional prerogatives. And so he set about having a law written which would, A, allow him to do that kind of surgery, and, B, immunize him so that he could never be successfully sued. So that's part of the up-close and personal detail of how the Buck case eventually gets to court.
Yeah, and after the Supreme Court found for the state of Virginia, a number of other states used this as a model kind of statute, and at some point, I believe there were 30 states that had laws like this on their books.
Yes, at the time of at the time Dr. Priddy's law is passed, that's 1924. The Virginia Sterilization Act is actually put into place. And prior to the time of the Buck lawsuit, which follows that, there were probably a dozen or so states that already had laws, starting with Indiana in 1907, had the very first law that focused on people in prisons, men who were sex criminals primarily. And then many states after that, states as widely divergent as California and New York and New Jersey, Connecticut, Oregon, Washington, and a bunch of states in the middle, adopted laws that focused, again, on institutionalized populations, people in asylums or homes for the mentally ill, et cetera. So there was a track record of law. The laws had been challenged in some states, and some states overturned and others not. But the leaders of the national eugenics movement who were interested in sterilization discussed a great deal the need for a kind of national standard, and they knew that a law that was appealed to the United States Supreme Court and then endorsed there would give them that kind of standard.
Yeah. Something that it seems very striking to me is that at the same time that all this was going on, this was a time when within the scientific community, at least within the mainstream scientific community, this kind of eugenic thinking was really losing any legitimacy that it ever had.
That's true. The first rifts between the scientists occur as early as 1913, and you have people like Thomas Hunt Morgan, who was the first person to win a Nobel Prize for genetics in 1933. Morgan is one of the first directors of the Eugenics Record Office in New York, along with people like Alexander Graham Bell and others. And he very quickly breaks with his colleagues. He does this privately and not publicly, but he breaks with his colleagues and says, you know, I'm studying fruit flies, and there are something like, dozens of genes that control something as simple as a fruit fly's eye, and arguments that you people are making that things as complex as human behavior are controlled by only one gene, those arguments don't make any sense. So there was a certainly debate and ferment and disagreement among the scientists quite early on, which never really made it into the public eye quite as dramatically as the pronouncements of some people that sterilization and getting people out of the stream of reproductive commerce would be the solution to our social ills.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Paul Lombardo. He is professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law, and he is the author of the book Three Generations, No Imbeciles, Eugenics, the Supreme Court, and Buck v. Bell, and it is published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. And it is about this particular case, Supreme Court's a case of Buck v. Bell from 1927, and also about the movement that was in existence at the time and a kind of a thinking that held on for a long time that said that certain people considered to be socially undesirable. It would be better for society if these people didn't have any children. And this was all about the state laws that gave the states the authority to involuntarily sterilize these people. And in fact, it's been estimated that something like 60,000 people were involuntarily sterilized under laws like this that existed in many states. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455 is the number to call if you'd like to be in on the conversation. Well, let's talk about Carrie Buck, because it seems that clearly the people here, the eugenics movement, was interested in a kind of a case that would allow them to make the argument that these laws were necessary and appropriate. And so they fastened on to Carrie and to her own particular situation. So let's talk about Carrie Buck. Who was Carrie Buck?
Carrie Buck is a girl who's about 17 years old in 1924, and she has been living with a foster family. She's taken from her own mother when she's quite young, 5 or 6 years old. And she finds herself in 1924 pregnant. The problem is she doesn't have a husband. So she is about to give birth to a child who is illegitimate. And she is identified by the local welfare authorities and by her foster parents as someone who needs to be sent away, as girls were in those days, sent away to some place where she won't be around to shame the family. She is sent to the Virginia Colony for the Epileptic and the Feeble-Minded, where her mother, Emma, already lives. She's already been committed there several years earlier. A nurse is dispatched to do an evaluation of Carrie's baby, who's about 6 months old, and the nurse says there's something kind of unusual, maybe not normal, a little peculiar about the baby, and that's about all she says. But Dr. Pretty, back at the state colony, who is looking for a way of using his brand-new eugenical sterilization law, attaches himself to that idea. He has a mother there, he has a daughter, and then he has identified the granddaughter, all three generations of women, all three, according to Dr. Pretty, touched with a hereditary problem of being promiscuous and feeble-minded and fitting within the language of the law that he had just had passed, socially inadequate, as the law said. Mm-hmm. So he identifies the Buck family as the perfect trilogy to take forward in a test case, which will make its way up through the courts of appeals, hopefully for him, to the United States Supreme Court.
And maybe at this point, I said at the beginning, we would at one point, for people who were not really sure what the title was really referring to, what that was all about. This is jumping ahead a little bit, but that essentially is a reflection of what it was that the court, one member of the court in particular, said about this case and about this family.
Yes, Carrie Buck's case actually goes to trial. She is given a lawyer. They put together a case against her, which focuses on the allegation of hereditary feeble-mindedness and hereditary illegitimacy and prostitution, etc. Carrie is called a moral degenerate and a moral degraded person, and she becomes the focal point of the case, which at that point is called Pretty versus Buck. The court says they believe the theory of eugenics and that it's been proven that this woman is hereditarily tainted. Case goes up to the next level of appeal, and it's also endorsed. Dr. Pretty dies along the way, and Dr. Bell takes his place, so the case becomes known as Buck versus Bell. When it reaches the United States Supreme Court, Chief Justice William Howard Taft, he'd already been president, he was now Chief Justice of the court, very, very comfortable with the ideas of eugenics and a supporter himself, hands off the writing of the opinion to the senior justice there, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. And, of course, Holmes is a great phrase maker. In this case, he looks at the record, he reviews the parties, and he reaches the conclusion that Virginia law is constitutional. And he writes an opinion, which is the opinion for 8 justices. There was only one who dissented and didn't leave any written dissent, so we're not sure exactly why. But for the 8 other justices, Holmes says it's better for all the world rather than waiting for degenerate offspring to starve because they're criminals or because they're imbeciles. It's better for those people to not be born at all. And he ends his opinion with this phrase, which everyone remembers. He says of the Buck family, 3 generations of imbeciles are enough. Mm-hmm.
Where at the time, there it seems very clear that on the court, all the members except one apparently strongly supported or believed in the idea of eugenic sterilization. A lot of other people did too. Were there people who were shocked by that decision and by that the words that Mr. Justice Holmes chose to use?
Apparently, even members of the court were shocked. Holmes wrote in his private correspondence to one of his friends that that he had irritated some of his colleagues on the court by the brutality of his phrasing and the coldness of some of the language that he used. But that became the kind of catchphrase for the eugenics movement. There were people who certainly were shocked by it outside of the court, and there were people who criticized it outside of the court. But in general, most of the opposition to eugenic sterilization seemed to go away. It seemed as if the court had overridden the general concerns that people had about that process.
Yeah, and maybe I am getting some callers here, but maybe one other detail certainly we want to mention here that goes to the argument that people made that somehow Carrie Buck, because she was an unwed teenage mother, was somehow morally unfit. Her pregnancy was not the result of consensual sex. She was sexually assaulted by a family member of this family in which she was living.
Correct. The foster mother had a nephew, and the nephew was the father of the child. Carrie related to several people and to me right before she died in the early 1980s that she had been assaulted, that she'd been raped, and that's why the child was born. She also she was unaware of some of the background details, but I think one of the more startling details of this case is that the lawyer who was appointed to represent Carrie was a man who had been one of the first directors of the Virginia colony, and he had voted in favor of sterilization. In fact, had advocated for sterilization of the inmates there as early as 1915. I demonstrate in the book, I think, that this case was a sham. And as you said earlier, it was really based on deceit. Carrie Buck was betrayed by her lawyer, who never really presented a defense at all. The other side presented 10 witnesses. He didn't present any. And it's clear from the records of the case that he was happy to lose.
Yeah, it was the case was completely stacked against her. There was no way that she could have won because even the person who was appointed to defend her was a supporter of the idea of eugenic sterilization.
That's correct.
We have a couple of callers here, and we will go next or first to someone in Urbana, here where we are. This would be line number one. Hello.
Hello, Harry.
Yes.
Thank you for the book. I mean, it's really important that you're writing this, and I hope it gets a lot of press, and I hope it's read by a lot of people, because what happened was, you know, a precursor to, you know, the Germans and Nazis and also probably the Russians during the gulags, where you just select out people that are not fit the mold and get rid of them. But I wanted to ask you, this book actually is important because it actually applies to now, where genetically engineered people, to use that loose term, they're starting to, you know, select out genes that are, you know, like you have Parkinson's and stuff like that, which is understandable, to remove those from the genome. And or then pretty soon it'll be hair color, and then pretty soon it'll be, if assuming there is some sort of gene for moods or whatever. But in a way, it's real interesting how it's come through the back door now as an improvement. Instead of eradicating people or sterilizing them, you can go into the embryo and make the changes there. So do you think that would apply? Do your thesis follow through to where it's now a backdoor approach?
Well, I think you raise a fascinating and hard question, and that is how much are modern technologies related to genetics close to what they did in terms of sterilization. Let me see if I can make a couple distinctions. The argument that I make in this book is that it's extremely dangerous to give to government the power to decide who can have children or who must have children. That the idea that we will make good decisions through the government about individual matters like that is probably an idea that I don't endorse. I think that the Buck case, if it stands for anything, stands for how government tends to botch it when it gets involved in these very private matters. Now, there are still practices going on that look an awful lot like the kinds of eugenics that Carrie Buck suffered through, and that those practices are judges making orders for people to be sterilized. It still goes on. There are examples I give in the book of cases as recently as a year ago where a judge decides that a woman's an unfit mother and says you may not have any more children, and I won't give you the children you have back into your custody until you're sterilized. So that kind of thinking is still around, and I think that, that's the kind of thing that we ought to be on the lookout for. As for the Genome Project and the kinds of questions that it raises, I think you're correct that we have very hard questions to answer about what kinds of people we're going to decide to live with and which ones we're going to decide to eliminate at the genetic level. I think those are troubling prospects about genetic research, but I do think they also need to be separated from the idea that the government is going to decide that. I think when we're in a situation where the government can decide what kind of children you have, then we are really back in the old eugenics era.
Yeah, and I agree, and that's a really valid point. I sort of missed that when you were talking, but I wanted to also say that we also remember how medicine is corporate now, and we also don't want corporations deciding either, so that it's kind of a balance in law. And I really want to thank you for this book, because what the Supreme Court did was virtually criminal, and I think you're right about saying it's one of the most despicable, outside of maybe the slavery, can't remember the case now, but it just amazing. And thanks for the book. I really appreciate your work.
Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe just one further quick point to touch on something the caller said, that after this case, after Buck versus Bell in 1927, a number of other states adopted similar kinds of laws. And in fact, this decision was very influential around the world, that people around the world used it to justify eugenic sterilization practices. And in fact, in Germany, the Nazi regime used this as a kind of a justification for their own kind of eugenic policies.
It's true that the Nazis paid a great deal of attention to what was going on in America. And in 1934, by that time in America, you have almost all of the states that are going to pass laws. The last one was actually passed in 1937. There are 32 states, by my count, that pass laws, and then Puerto Rico on top of that, by the late 1930s. But in 1934, the Nazis, as one of the very first acts of the Hitler regime, pass a very expansive sterilization law, more expansive than anything in America, and use it to sterilize some 400,000 people in a few short years. It turns out that after the war, there was some movement on the part of the prosecutors at Nuremberg to investigate those sterilizations. But then they agreed that they really couldn't do anything because similar practices had occurred in America. They then went to focus on not domestic German law, but actually war crimes, what happened in the camps to people who were not German citizens. And they discovered after investigating that several thousand people were sterilized using really tortuous methods of caustic chemicals, x-rays, et cetera, and experimentally sterilized to determine if there was a better, faster way to do it. And so after the war, those people were prosecuted, the Nazi doctors at Nuremberg in 1947, for doing research, what they called research. It was really torture and murder in the guise of research. And that was one of the counts against them at the Nuremberg trials. Their attorneys, the Nazi attorneys, turned around and read into the record the opinion from Buck versus Bell as part of their justification for those practices.
Another caller here, Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. The eugenics movement, you know, it had some very famous pioneers whose names you know and who will shock you. Let me read a couple of quotations, and please tell me who made these statements. First statement, quote, "The weak members of civilized society propagate their kind. This must be highly injurious to the race of man. Excepting in the case of man himself, hardly anyone is so ignorant as to allow his worst animals to breed," unquote. Who said that?
Well, why don't you tell us?
Charles Darwin. And by the way, his book is supposed to be his famous book, On the Origin of Species. That's not quite the title. It was on the origin of most favored races. It was a racist book. Let me give you another quote. Here's a quote: "Birth control is nothing more or nothing less than the facilitation of the process of weeding out the unfit, or preventing the birth of defectives or those who will become defectives." Unquote. Who said that?
You have the phone.
Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood.
You know, it's interesting that you should pick out Darwin and Sanger, because it sounds to me like you are making an argument that I hear a lot lately, that Margaret Sanger and Charles Darwin were responsible for the eugenics movement and then the Holocaust. And I find that fascinating, because I could have answered your first question when you said who said that, because it sounded to me an awful lot like Teddy Roosevelt, who said similar things. It also sounded like Herbert Hoover, who was one of the first supporters of the Second International Eugenics Congress in New York City in 1921. It could have been Woodrow Wilson, who signed a eugenics law when he was governor of New Jersey, or for that matter, economists like Irving Fisher, or lots of other people, Thomas Edison, the doctor who founded the Mayo Clinics. There were many, many, many supporters of eugenics and many supporters of eugenic sterilization. We tend these days to try to turn around and blame those processes on a few people who we may dislike politically. But in fact, it was a widespread movement. Five presidents from the first part of the 20th century all the way up until 1930 who supported eugenics in one form or the other. So it's a very broadly based movement, and one in which the attitudes that you are reciting would have been endorsed by lots of people, some of whom have their faces on Mount Rushmore.
Well, you know, that's true. But I think the lesson here, and I think you would agree with me, that our leadership can get us into, if we follow our leadership too blindly, we can really get ourselves into trouble. We've got to be thoughtful in the ways we follow. Right now, we know that in the past we have been guilty of enslaving hundreds of thousands of people, and right now we have an enlightened process we think is a constitutional right, in which without anesthetic, we disembowel, dismember an innocent baby, flush him down the sewer, and call it choice. That's happening right now on Main Street, and our leaders are endorsing it. So we got to be careful.
Well, you can comment on that any way that you like or not, Professor Lombardo.
Well, I think that, you know, again, I one of the reasons I wrote this book was to point out what I consider to be the very detailed history of a specific Supreme Court case, and show how it was the result not of so much of big ideas, but of one idea that was carried out by individuals in an extraordinarily nasty way.
Yeah.
And I hope that I've been able to do that in this book. And I don't think any grand claims, except the one, which is that I guess I would agree with the caller that we need to be careful about what we entrust to government.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the thing that strikes me is, while today I would hope and trust there wouldn't be widespread support for an idea like eugenic sterilization, however, it is my suspicion that in the popular mind, this idea that negative traits, things that make people quote-unquote socially undesirable, are somehow passed on. I think that people haven't completely let go of that idea.
You're correct. I don't think people have let go of it at all. And frankly, after calls like talk shows like this one, or interviews I've given for newspapers and then read the blogs that followed, there's always a certain number of people who think that sterilizing people on welfare, sterilizing people who are criminals, sterilizing anybody is a good idea. And the argument that I have tried to make most loudly is that there are some principles that some of us would argue are part of the Constitution that we shouldn't really throw away too quickly. And there are some bright lines, and one of those bright lines is that we shouldn't do surgery on people who don't want it and don't need it. Using medical as a tool of statecraft medical technology as a tool of statecraft and forcing medicine and procedures on people who don't want those procedures is just a bad idea. I liken sterilization, coercive sterilization, to torture. That we might all be able to dream up an idea and an occasion and a special hypothetical in which we'd say, well, maybe, just maybe, this is the time we should throw away that rule and go ahead and torture someone. Maybe this is the time we should go ahead and sterilize someone because we've got the right case. I think those are lines we should not cross in either case.
Yeah. Real quick, going back to Carrie Buck and her mother and daughter, as you explained, the people there in Virginia that were trying to make the case that it was important for them to be able to do this, to sterilize people like them so that they did not reproduce, that they felt that they had this ideal case, they had these three generations, they had Carrie, her mother, and her daughter, and they had judged that they were defective people. And the judging of the baby, Carrie's baby, apparently sounds pretty cursory and probably that was done by people who had their minds made up even before they went to do the valuation. But, we could have had an objective evaluation of these three women, of Carrie, her daughter, and her mother, would we have found that they were mentally ill, developmentally disabled, that there was something that really could have been identified, some kind of a problem that could have been identified?
Well, I think that the easiest one to talk about is Carrie. We know the most about Carrie. She lived the longest, and we have firsthand information about her. I interviewed her in 1983. She died soon thereafter. What I found was what I had been told by medical professionals and psychologists and others who had known her, and that was that she was perfectly normal. She had gone, the records tell us, to school for about 5 or 6 years, not unusual for a girl born in 1906. She'd done quite well, not great, but adequate, and gotten good grades in her behavior and deportment when she left school. Carrie, I think, was simply a victim of circumstance and a victim all the way through, from the way she was treated by her foster parents to the way she was treated by the young man who impregnated her, and then her lawyer, and then the Supreme Court. Her daughter, Vivian, we knew really the least about for the longest time, but I was happy to find Vivian's grades in the grade school that she went to for 2 years. She died when she was only 8 years old. But in the 2 years of school, she ended up at least once on the school honor roll, which would suggest that there was nothing wrong with her mind. Emma, who's Carrie's mother, is the person we probably don't have much information on. Emma seems to have been physically ill in lots of different ways, if you look at the medical record. And she was had children taken away from her when she was quite, middle-aged. So it's just not clear whether she was a bad mother, whether she had a drug problem. There's some suggestion of that. But there really is no suggestion that she was mentally ill either. And that's really why I entitled my book, Three Generations, No Imbeciles.
Yeah. Very quickly here, our guest, Paul Lombardo. He's professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law. His book is about the case of Buck versus Bell, went to the Supreme Court in 1927. And indeed, if you want to read the story, you can look for his book, Three Generations, No Imbeciles, and it's published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. We have some callers here to get back to here in Champaign County, where we are, line number one. Hello.
Hi, I really appreciate how nuanced your approach to the subject is, and particularly these last callers. I think there is a way that you can talk about an abuse of social Darwinism, you know, going into this eugenics movement. They're certainly true, but I think it's probably from the record you can find a religious argument for eugenics similar to what there was a religious argument for slavery. So I mean, it was ubiquitous, this idea that there were bad families and bad groups. There was a guest previously had written a book on the so-called bad families theory, and I asked about the Ben Ishmaelites, and in the process of looking into this group, I found some assertions that they actually ran their own communities and that they must have possibly had some Islamic influence, and that was also one of the things that made them an outcast and group, because they apparently named Morocco and Mecca, Indiana, and are the authors of the original name Muhammad in a town close to here. They were forced out at some point, but the name came back. But I'm wondering whether you treat this idea, this broader groupings. I mean, I think there was some reference to the Jukes, to this family that was also supposedly notoriously defective.
Yes.
I don't know if there's a question in there.
Yes. Well, I can tell you that I think you're on the right track. That I do know Nathaniel Deutsch's book about the worst family, as he calls it, and focusing on the Indianapolis Ishmaelites many years ago. And as he says in his book, and as I do in mine, there was, as you say, a series of so-called problem families and studies of those families that turned into books. The two most famous ones are the ones that I write about, the Jukes and the Kallikaks. And the one of the people who was the expert witness in the Buck case, a man named Arthur Estabrook, had actually come to Indiana to find the Ishmaelites and then gone back to New York to study the so-called Jukes family, which was a New York Hudson Valley clan that supposedly filled the prisons and the almshouses. When Carrie Buck's trial takes place, it's really the theory of the people who want to have her sterilized that the Buck family is another one of these problem families, that they're just like the Jukes or Goddard's Kallikak family. They are hereditarily tainted, and they will have children who will be running up the social tab for the rest of us. And so this idea of generational curse and generational guilt comes through very clearly. And another point that you made I think is important, and that is how even religious ideas were perverted and used to justify eugenics. There are many, many reoccurring recitations of the phrase about how the sins of the father will be transmitted to the son unto the third generation. And clearly those arguments were made by people who are evoking religion. In some cases, there were contests by preachers to write the best eugenic sermon during this same period. So all kinds of reform personalities played a role, some of them religious, some of them non-religious, some of them scientific or focused on things like abolition of alcohol and lots of other social reform movements.
Yeah, I was specifically thinking of the Estabrook track because apparently he came out from the East to study the Indianapolis Ben Ishmaelite phenomenon. And the last time I checked, it wasn't available on the web except in a facsimile format, which was a little hard to manage. But, the ubiquity of it is just astonishing. And I guess it's not a surprise, then, that we still have so many people that still sort of just unconsciously are just without examination accept this as a commonplace. So
I think that's thank you. For people who are in the Indiana area, we were successful a couple years ago at putting up a marker there. The first marker for eugenics was put up in Virginia in 2002. The governor apologized, and we put up a historic marker that indicated what happened in the case, tried to correct the record. And on the 100th anniversary of the Indiana law, which was 2007, a group of my colleagues and I were able to convince the state to put up a historic marker there on the statehouse grounds in Indianapolis, also addressing the eugenics history of Indiana.
Another caller here. We'll go on to someone in, I believe, in Champaign and on line number two. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
This is in response to the earlier caller who bashed Darwin. It sounds like he got his information possibly from Ben Stein's atrocious movie, which is very misleading and full of lies, Expelled. If you go to the website expelledexposed.com, you can find a lot of refutations of that. One specifically, the end of his quote of Darwin reads as follows: "The aid which we feel impelled to give the helpless is mainly an incidental result of the instinct of sympathy, which was originally acquired as part of the social instincts, but subsequently rendered, in the manner previously indicated, more tender and more widely diffused. Nor could we check our sympathy, if so urged by hard reason, without deterioration of the noblest part of our nature." So, you know, this is a very misleading quote, and I suspect the same thing is true for, you know, the founder of Planned Parenthood. That's taken out of context and not given the full quote. Kind of a sad reflection on the state of miseducation in our country, I guess.
Well, again, Professor Lombardo, I think as far as Margaret Sanger is concerned, though, that in fact she did strongly believe in the idea of eugenics, and that's just part of her.
It's true that Sanger said some things that we would find today pretty outrageous. This is a history which has been teased out in great detail, and oftentimes Sanger is given a lot of credit as a person who was somehow a leader in the eugenics movement. She really wasn't. She wanted to be, but there were men like Charles Davenport who really was a leader in the eugenics movement, who was very much against the idea of birth control. He and lots of people in the earlier generation thought that was a bad idea completely. As for abortion, Davenport and Laughlin, Harry Laughlin, his first lieutenant, who wrote a whole book on sterilization, specifically say that they would rule out the idea of abortion. So trying to connect institutions and ideas from today to institutions and ideas from 80 or 100 years ago is a pretty difficult thing to do. You run into a lot of dead ends when you actually follow those threads where they lead.
We're coming down to the point here. We have maybe 2-3 minutes left. I know that you first, I believe you write in the book about the fact that you first became aware of the case, or at least started reading about the case of Buck versus Bell back in 1980. And since that time, you certainly have written a lot about it and spoken about it and raised awareness about it and have been instrumental in, as you say, having some markers put up, recognizing this and getting some state governments to formally apologize for what had been done to people like Carrie. So this has become now, you may in fact know more about this kind of thing than a lot of other people. The question is, why do you think that this particular case is not better known and this chapter of American history is not better known?
Well, for a long time, the eugenics movement just wasn't discussed. When I was in school, I never heard about it. The first full-length book gets written 1963, and a man named Pickens writes a book about eugenics, and there's several after that. But up until about the 1980s, there really isn't a whole lot of information about eugenics. And I think that's because this is a very dark and nasty part of our background. And it's a part that didn't end until recently. We had sterilization laws on the books from 1907 to at least the 1980s. We have a couple states that still have them, Mississippi and Washington State. They don't use them, I don't think, but they're on the books anyway. We had racial restriction laws based on eugenics. You couldn't marry somebody of a different race. Those laws weren't struck down by the Supreme Court until 1967. We had a Immigration Restriction Act, the National Immigration Restriction Act, that intentionally set quotas to keep out Italians and Jews. That was passed in 1924, not overturned until the 1960s. And so this is not ancient history. This is relatively recent history. We have states like North Carolina trying to get reparations, some of the legislators there, for people who were sterilized as late as the 1960s and the 1970s. I've documented sterilizations in Virginia all the way up to 1979. So this is a nasty history. It does have links to Hitler. It's a part of the past that we'd rather not talk about because it's tied in with segregation and Jim Crow and slavery and many other events in American history that are not pleasant. I think that our children ought to actually know about these things rather than hiding them, pretending that they didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned a little earlier about the fact that Carrie Buck died in 1983, but shortly, I think, before she passed away, you had the opportunity to meet her.
I did. We had a brief conversation. She had just gone through the Christmas pageant at the senior home that she was living at, and we had a nice talk. Although she wasn't well, and I didn't know it at the time, but she wasn't going to last more than another 3 weeks. I was happy that I had that occasion, though, because I was able to verify in my own mind that the evidence I was finding about this case made sense. This was a woman who had been railroaded. There was nothing wrong with her. And I think that we shouldn't put too fine a point on that. I'm not suggesting that if there had been something that was problematic, if she had a cognitive problem, for example, that it would have been okay to sterilize her. I don't believe that either. Mm-hmm. But in this case, it was doubly problematic because she was, as I said, betrayed.
She did have this baby. Her daughter apparently died in 1932. She was, I think, 8. You said the person we know the most about is Carrie. Maybe we know a little bit more about the daughter. I think her name was Vivian.
Right.
And then we know perhaps even less about Carrie's mother. Do you know anything about the circumstances of Vivian's life?
Vivian was raised by the same woman who raised Carrie, a woman named Dobbs. Raised in the same house, and apparently Ms. Dobbs became very, very attached to Vivian. She considered her own child. She would never put down Carrie Buck's name on official documents like the birth certificate or the death certificate. So the girl was raised as Vivian Alice Elaine Dobbs, and that was her identity. I have a feeling that she had a reasonably pleasant life because she was raised from being an infant in that same house. Unfortunately, she got sick, got the measles in 1932, and sometime that summer apparently developed a secondary infection and died.
Well, we are at the point that we're going to have to finish. It is a fascinating story, and if people would like to read it, you look for the book that we mentioned. Again, the title is Three Generations, No Imbeciles. The subtitle is Eugenics, the Supreme Court, and Buck v. Bell. The book is published by the Johns Hopkins University Press by our guest, Paul Lombardo. He is professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law. And Professor Lombardo, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you. I'm happy I could do it.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you are ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.
Support for Focus 580 comes from the Infant Parent Institute. Celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign, the Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infant-parent.com. Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
The 2009 All-Day Agricultural Outlook meeting is in the books. We now have audio from the meeting on our website at willag.org. Our thanks to these agribusinesses that helped to make this year's meeting a success. The Andersons, DTM, AgriGold Hybrids, ADM Investor Services, and L&M Commodities. Let's go right to the pits at the Chicago Board of Trade and in Kansas City. March wheat in Kansas City now at 559.5, down 14.5. July 577, down 7.5 at the Chicago Board of Trade. March wheat 506.5, down 8.75. July 530.75, down 6.5. March corn 379.5, up 2.75. May 386.75, up 1.5. July 396.5, up 1. December 416.5, up 3/4. April crude oil 47.28, up 25 cents. The April RBOB 137.3, up 2.7. March beans 887 down 12, May 873 down 9, July 872.5 down 9, and November 829, now 828.75 down 12.75. March soybean meal 287.10. Well, excuse me, let's go to the May contract. It's bouncing all over the place, and I'm going to go ahead and click in on a different screen for you for that quote. The March soybean meal contract is now trading at, here we go, 287.20, down 180. The May 273.90 down 260. The March soybean oil contract at 29.86 down 25. The May at 30.10, it's down 28. April live cattle 84.07.5, and that's up 17.5. June 81.75 down 7.5. March feeders 91.40 up 50. And April 91.77.5 up 57.5. April lean hog 63.05 up 82.5. May at 73 up 37.5. You're listening to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.